This is Bill Bruford, the ever-enthusiastic young drummer from the group Yes, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
So here we are back with part 4A of our What Did They Do Next series, and this time we have to consider Rick Wakeman. Now, fortunately, I don't know very much about Rick Wakeman, but we do have someone on the team who knows a huge amount and has got a huge collection of Rick Wakeman artifacts and records and so on, and that's Mark. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. So, Rick Wakeman then, leaving Yes. Now, I've got in front of me two books that we can use to hear what he said himself or what the circumstances were for Rick leaving. And that's not what we're doing here. We're talking about what he did after leaving. But I thought it was just worth reading out a couple of bits. So in 1976, this is from Tim Morse's, who we had on last week, Yes Stories, fantastic book. In 1976, Rick said, so this is quite a short time afterwards, I had some great times and some lousy times. It was a band that was bonded together by music. There was little love lost. It wasn't bad until things got to a stage where I didn't know what direction the music was going in. I didn't enjoy Tales from Topographic Oceans, so I finished out the European tour we were doing and left. Now, much later in 1988, he said, I've got many failings, but I do have high musical ethics. And I said straight out that I didn't want to play that music, and that I thought I should leave the band. This was not to take away from the other guys in the band that felt just as strongly in the opposite way. It was a very bizarre situation. I was due to start rehearsing with Yes for an American tour when I decided to call management and tell them I was going to leave the band. Not more than a minute later, A&M Records in London called to tell me my solo album, Journey to the Centre of the Earth, had just gone number one in the charts. On top of it all, it was my birthday. It was a strange, mixed day. I wasn't happy about leaving Yes, but ethically, I had to. Now, and that, I thought that was really interesting when you compare that to the way that other people we've already talked about left the band. He felt that ethically he just couldn't play the music that they were talking about playing. He was obviously very unhappy with Tales, and he didn't want to be involved with some of the material. I think that he, you know, it was very early on involved with some of those Relayer ideas, certainly. So not the sort of thing he wanted to be playing. But I'm just wondering, and perhaps you know better than I do, Mark, how much it had to do with the fact that he was already an incredibly successful solo artist.
Well, let's look at it this way. Now, he makes no bones about the fact that he loves Yes and he loves being in the band. I mean, he's returned to this band how many times? Like three, yeah. Four times. So obviously, if he didn't enjoy the music and the people involved in it, he wouldn't be returning to it.
No.
So, but of course, when you're young, and you know, you want to get out there and experience life and tour and stuff like that, having a number one hit record is something that's very appealing and gives you the means to go out and do those things. I mean, once Journey went number one,
yeah,
I mean, he was allowed to go do worldwide tours everywhere with this album, and not just you know three guys and him. He actually dragged along symphonies and choirs. It was ridiculous what this guy was doing on tours. I mean, he was losing upwards of hundreds of thousands of dollars each tour because of it.
Yes.
And he didn't really care. I mean, he was 25 years old or whatever he was back then, and just, you know, just went ahead with what he wanted to do.
Absolutely. And I think that's a crucial part of it. And it's interesting what he said over the years about Tales, because that's the traditional line, is that he hated Tales so much he had to leave. And there's that famous example of him eating a curry on stage, which was supposed to be... there are different versions of that story, of course, as there are about all Yes stories. But clearly, his mind wasn't 100% on the music if he was prepared to do that, even if it wasn't actually bought for him or whatever. But something in Dave Watkinson's book, and we're going to get a chance to talk to Dave about his new book in a minute, but in his fantastic Perpetual Change book, there's another interesting part of the Topographic Oceans saga. When we did, and this is Rick Wakeman again, when we did Tales from Topographic Oceans, which, to put it bluntly, was not my favourite album, I'll own up, John and I have had conversations about this since. We both agree, now this is the interesting bit, so John Anderson and Rick Wakeman, we both agree that if CDs had been available then, there was enough good material on that album to make a 50-minute CD. We had a bit too much to go on an album of 36 minutes, but not enough for a double album, so it was padded mercilessly, and that really upset me. So it wasn't the fact that he thought Tales was all rubbish. He didn't. There were some bits in it, which I know he's gone on record since, saying that, you know, there's some real gems within there, but he thought it was padded. And I understand what he means, but that's not my attitude towards Tales.
No, I mean, it is an interesting theory, but the one thing that I find kind of odd about that is that when you pad something, it means that you add stuff to it that just, you know, isn't exactly good material just to lengthen the album. Yeah. Now, you know, but so what he's saying is that they had CD, they'd have more opportunity to put more stuff on there. But isn't that what he was complaining about to begin with, that the padding was what sucked? So why would you want to make it longer if the padding was terrible? I mean, maybe he means, though, that if they knew ahead of time that they could put more on there, they maybe would have focused on stronger, longer pieces, maybe, is maybe what he was thinking about. You know, maybe expanding on some of the ones that they did, and then not without fear of, you know, running out of time. So, this is all interesting to talk about because we can talk about it now knowing how the end result was, right?
Yes.
But, you know, back then, you know, who knows what they're really thinking, how they really thought about some of these things, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's all we'll talk about Tales and yes, specifically at the moment with Rick, because he did leave, and the first thing he did after leaving was creating The Myths, to give it its full title. It must be one of the longest titles of any album. The Myths and Legends of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. So there we are. Now, what this got me thinking was, and we'll go a bit more into why it was so excessive, and this is one of the albums, only one of Rick's albums that got the whole genre tarred with the same brush of excess, I think, but we'll come back to that. But what it did put me in mind of was the fact that Yes are often held up as the really excessive prog rockers. Now, I don't think that's actually the case when you look at what Rick Wakeman was up to. I think Rick Wakeman has much more of a claim to rock and roll excess, and particularly prog rock excess. Because if you think about Yes, okay, they had a double album, Tales. They had very elaborate stage sets from Roger Dean and his brother Martin Dean. But that's really as far as it went. They did a little bit with orchestra for their second album, but you couldn't call that total prog excess. And they came back to using an orchestra with magnification many, many years later. But when you think about prog excess, I think it's really Rick Wakeman you mean, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I say that without any hesitation, because let's face it, if you talk prog excess to any sort of, journalist or historian of music, the first name that comes out of their mouth is Rick Wakeman every single time, whether it's about, you know, the excessive capes that blind the eyes with all the glitter on it, or whether it's, you know, bringing out these massive choirs and stuff like that for his shows, or the one thing that gets always quoted, and it's this album that we have to thank for, is the big calamity that was King Arthur on Ice. You know, I mean, if there's one thing that prog excess can always, you know, look at itself in the mirror and say, wow, I can't believe we did that, is, you know, the King Arthur on Ice bit, because it's just ridiculous. I mean, and I'm happy that I actually have this on DVD, a nice copy of it. I sent you over some photos of the actual package there. And, you know, as ridiculous as it sounds, if you watch it, it's not as bad as history makes it out to be, in my opinion. I mean, others may argue with that, but it's not as terrible as it is. I mean, sure, some of the people that are skating around are kind of looking at each other going, what are we supposed to be doing here when they're skating around with these ridiculous horse outfits on, right? But, you know, look, let's put it this way. Rick had a number one record with Journey, okay? He leaves Yes, makes this album, and this album comes out, and, you know, much to nobody's surprise, it's number 2 on the UK charts, number 21 on the US Billboard charts. It's certified gold in US, Brazil, Japan, Australia. So the man has money coming in left, right, and center. A&M are doing whatever he wants to do. And when they tell them that he can pretty much do whatever he wants, what does he say? Let's do 3 shows at Wembley Arena and do it as an ice show. Now, they had to do it because there was already something going to be done. Like, I think it was like an ice capade sort of deal. So they couldn't put the arena back in normal situation. So Rick, of course, in his, you know, much questioned mental state at that point, said, great, that would just turn into an ice capade thing, because he actually mentioned it on a television interview. So once he actually said it, there was no turning back.
Right, right. Yes, that's right. And I dug into this a little bit, and this is not really what we do in this. We talk about what we already know, but I did look a little bit about it because, you know, I remember it because it was broadcast on British TV at the time. And it must be one of my earliest memories, because I do actually remember it being on the television in our house, which again is a bizarre thing, because my parents certainly weren't prog rock aficionados or anything. But I suppose it was one of those amazing events that everybody had their telly on at the time and did watch it. So I do remember it actually live, which is a bizarre thing to think now, all these decades later. But yes, I looked into it a little bit, and he wanted to do it at Tintagel. And the reason for that is that that's one of the possible sites of Camelot. And of course, with Camelot being the place where the myths and legends of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table did take place, then that would have been a great idea. But he couldn't get permission to do it at Tintagel because it was, you know, it's up on the cliffs and it would be really dangerous and so on. And he couldn't even get permission to do it in a field near Tintagel, so he had to have it somewhere, and as you say, things just fell into place and he decided to do it on ice at Wembley. Just incredible. But let's talk about the music then. Mm-hmm. Next, so I haven't heard it. I may have heard bits, I suppose, through the years, but I haven't listened to it. I've got my CD on order, so when we come back to the Yes Music podcast after, I think we're going to have a couple of weeks break while I go off on my silver wedding anniversary trip. How exciting. So so a couple of weeks' time, we'll come back and talk about the music itself when I've had a chance to listen to it. But tell us a bit about that. Now, we're going to talk about the original recording. We'll come back to the other recordings that there have been in a minute. But just for the moment, what was that first recording like? Was it a single album, double album? What are the musical forces on it and those sorts of things?
Well, the original album was a single album, 7 songs. And it was one of those records that people who love collecting vinyl albums absolutely adore. Because, I mean, first of all, it's everything that you can imagine. I mean, you look at the album cover, you know, there's like a sword there into an anvil. You know, it's like typical what you would expect for this kind of a title, right?
Yeah.
And you open it, and it has like this nice grandiose sort of, you know, man on a horse jousting picture and stuff. But even better is you get this fantastic 12-page booklet, which I'm going to be sure to give you nice photos of for the podcast. Okay. That's included with it. That has a little write up about each song and fantastic drawings and illustrations. I mean, this is like something that really he took great time and care with of having included with this album. Now the music, I think, is very good. I love it. I mean, Rick's piano playing is probably one of the best records you'll hear as far as piano playing. I mean, Lady of the Lake and Guinevere have some fantastic piano parts on there. Mm. And he actually took the time to go to a separate recording studio to do the grand piano work, because he actually knows that there's this one particular studio, and I'm trying to remember offhand which studio this is. But in any case, we'll get into more detail the following episode. But he went to the studio because he knew that they had a specific grand piano that he likes using for recording. So he went to that studio to record all the piano pieces for this album. And it definitely was to his advantage, because the songs sound fantastic. The piano specifically is really well recorded. Mm. And the stories are very interesting. I mean, if you like this sort of history, these songs will definitely capture your imagination. I mean, side two has Merlin the Magician, which is probably one of the most popular songs that he has in his catalog. He always seems to play it. And Arthur, the opening track, I mean, let's put it this way. The BBC used Arthur for their election coverage from like 79 to like 1989. They used that music introduction to their BBC present.
I did not know that. Good grief. Right, okay.
So you can tell that obviously...
I might recognize that one then, yeah.
Yeah, so that one is obviously very well known to the British people, I'm sure. So I'm sure as soon as you put that CD on, you hear that, you're going to be like, I remember this now.
Right, yes.
So the music is very strong. I mean, you have, like I said, Arthur is like a 7-minute song. Lady of the Lake is only like a 45-minute introduction piece to Guinevere. And that's a great song. Very well thought. It's like a, it's like the ballady kind of song of the record, right? Okay. And Sir Lancelot is very well done. But of course, you get to the more epic pieces where he has the orchestras and the choirs, where you get into like the Sir Galahad and the Last Battle and stuff like that. You know, they're very much like, let's put it this way, a title, when you read it, you have something in your mind of what it could sound like. And these songs don't disappoint from that end.
Right. Okay, so what are the forces? We're not talking prog rock group here, are we? We're talking about massive forces.
Yes, of course, because there is a huge symphony with this too recording, and there's also a choir involved as well. So beside the normal, you know, Rick Wakeman, you know, ensemble, like what he calls his band, you have this other force, you know, 20 vocalists and 30 some odd, you know, instrumentalists on top of all this.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I'm very much looking forward to listening to that. But tell us about this though, this amazing parallel that there is between this and Tales, because it's not all on that original disc, is it?
No, because later on, he released a re-recording of this album in 2016. Now, what originally happened was he had done something similar for Journey, the Center of the Earth. Yeah. He did a re-recording because he claimed the same thing, that there was stuff missing that he couldn't do because of time constrictions. So he did the same thing with this album. We'll get into much more detail next time.
Yeah,
but there are things that were added to this. Like, for example, the album starts on the normal version with King Arthur, right? Mm. Now, on the extended version of it, it starts off with something called The King's Choice, which is more like an extended part of the He Who Pulls the Sword from the, you know, it's like one of those extended things. But he has things like that added to it. So like he has Lady of the Lake, and then he has Arthur's Queen, which is like another little piece added to it. And then he has like, you know, before Merlin the Magician, he has two smaller pieces in between, like the King of Merlins and then a Wizard's Potion. So that's the little pieces that he has that intertwine songs and just make it more of a story in complete way. Because he also added some other stuff that he wanted to add in there. Like he added the chalice and the Holy Grail, and he wanted to add also Percival the Knight. He wasn't able to do that in the other one. So he actually makes it a much more complete look at that history.
Yeah. Not padding, though.
No, absolutely. To me, it's not. I mean, to others, they would definitely say, yeah, it is padding.
More like Tales.
Yeah, because you know what? The people would say it might be padding because, you know, you're adding these 45 and 35 second pieces. Do you really need them? Well, in his mind, yeah, you do, because it adds to the story and makes it more complete in his mind.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, one of the things I like about the re-recording is there's that amazing Roger Dean artwork. So the original artwork was actually a photograph, wasn't it, of the anvil and the sword? But he goes in for the full Yes progressive thing with Roger Dean second time round.
Yeah, absolutely, and I'll give you pictures of that as well, because I do have this. But yeah, the artwork on that is just fantastic. I mean, it's one of those ones again where you just put it in front of you while you listen to it, and you can get totally immersed in the images that are done by Roger. Just fantastic stuff.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, well, I'm very, very much looking forward to listening to that properly and then getting back to everyone with part two, part B of this What Did They Do Next, which is Rick Wakeman. In the meantime, do listen to it yourself or re-listen to it if you haven't listened to it for years, and let us know what you think of the music on the show notes to this episode. But for the moment, and I will see you in a couple of weeks' time, Mark, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, and have a great time on your holiday.
Okay, we're delighted that Dave Watkinson is here with us today, and he had a very big birthday yesterday, apparently, according to social media, and he also announced something very exciting on his birthday. He's been here many times before talking about a certain book that he's been working on, but I think the time has come to actually make an official announcement, hasn't it, Dave?
It has. It's been a long time coming, as they say, but these things usually do take years and many ups and downs on the way to it. So there has been a recent big change where I've swapped the publisher from Plexus, who I've known since about 1999. And it just got complicated, really too complicated. It was going to be a huge wait for them to be back online. And so, Stephen, Sonic Bong has come forward and he's raring to go as such because he's a big Yes fan.
Yeah.
And he said, let's get this done and let's see what you've got. So he came over to my place and I showed him all the memorabilia, showed him the book, showed him the design, showed him my ideas. And he loved all the stuff that he's seen. And he said, yeah, let's do this.
Okay, well, let's just remind everyone listening exactly what the book is about. It's John Anderson and the Warriors. So it's pre-Yes stuff at first anyway, isn't it, in the book?
It is, yes. So it always puzzled me why he was in the band for 5 years and it was very rarely written about or anything known. I now know why, because it's ever so difficult to research 50 years ago. That's why. And everybody copied else for that one page in any Yes book on his previous. So with my Lancashire background, I thought I'd dig deep and find out really what was going on there and do a proper job on that. That's why it's taken like 4 years to find people, interview them and put it together and find the memorabilia.
Yeah, yeah.
So it will be from, it's almost like a little biographer for really John between day one and 1968, 69. So really 50 years ago.
Yeah, so it fits in nicely, doesn't it, with all the 50th anniversary things that we had last year and your plaque that you organised, and we had a fantastic time there talking to Bill Bruford and various others about Yes and about John Anderson and that whole time period. But this really gives us the backstory, doesn't it? This explains and fills in the details of who really John Anderson was in origin and how he got to Yes. So you must have discovered some pretty amazing things about John and the Warriors.
Well, I think you'll be surprised. I think that there's going to be an awful lot in here that is fresh and new, and that's what I wanted to do. Was I didn't want to... Well, I couldn't rehash more. There was only a page written about them, really. So I don't know how many pages I've got with all the information, 150. Yeah, there's a lot here that has never been seen or doesn't know. And then it stops about 68, 69. So you get some Yes at the end, and... I've got some memorabilia that's never been seen. That's with the Warriors and Yes. Mm. Obviously, I've been spending money and gaining things that I thought I had everything up until, well, I did. But then something happened relatively recently, which was just, wow, amazing moment when you find a whole bunch of stuff that no one's seen.
Yeah.
Not even myself knew about it or had it. So you'll see some images that of John in this band you've never seen. And they're like, wow.
So I'm curious, though, with this mention of memorabilia and stuff like that, I'm guessing back in those days and the memorabilia that would be available, I'm guessing it's more along the lines of maybe like 7-inch vinyl and maybe posters from old concerts along those lines.
Yeah, there was very, very little. In fact, there was very little photographs taken. If you think in this like 63, 64, up to 68, they're quite difficult to find any material at all. And so I'd gone to the libraries in Lancashire to find cuttings and gone through the archives for reports and any images, record companies. Finding this stuff, that's usually generally one picture, but I've just got so much now that no one's seen. The poster I recently just put up in the last couple of days, actually, that cost me a lot of money. It's probably the only one in the world. Mm. I know the band members, and they don't have it. No one has it. Never even seen it.
Yeah.
So, that's probably that's the earliest probably poster with John Anderson on it.
But, I mean, apart from the memorabilia, as you've already said, you've spoken to pretty much everybody who was still around who was involved with that Warriors band, haven't you?
I have. I've spoken to, a great deal of them, interviewed them all. We've got to catch them, obviously. It's late in the year. They're all 70s now, some fitter than others. And so, I've got the inside stories about the early days, John in Lancashire and in the band and all the other guys and what they did in either in Europe or in England. Mm. And then coming down to London and gigging around London and off to Germany and then forming. And then, going through the Mabel Greer's toy shop into the early years of starting Yes. Obviously, I don't want to go into Yes too much because there's plenty of books been out on that. And it's a nice prequel to the Perpetual Change, to be honest.
Yeah.
So if you read all this, you'll get the excitement and really is creativity and how that came about through all these different bands and in the beat music, and why he ended up where he was, and the kind of his Napoleon-ness, you know, because he just about had enough of all these rubbish bands and not listening to him. And so you get a bigger idea on why Yes, he wanted Yes to be like that, the driving force. So I hope somebody will like it.
I'm sure it's going to be fascinating. Now, tell us about the formats, though. You're going to release it in a couple of different formats, do I understand?
Yeah, this is Stephen's idea, and he suggested, why don't we do this in a very limited amount initially, something special. I said, yeah, great idea. So only 250 will be made for around about October time in hardback with jacket and signed by myself. That will be different. And in the new year, there'll be hopefully a softback, paperback, maybe a different cover, so maybe a smaller version for it. But the special edition, I thought that's a great idea, actually. That's a nice collectible. Yes. As, you know, I'm interested in that kind of thing, so I just create one. And it will be a fairly large format. And the other thing is that I want it like Perpetual Change, so there's not many publishers who will do what I want in the design. Right. So I'm very specific, and I want the pictures to run through the book, not just a middle section or an end section.
Yeah,
I want it to look like that, and he's willing to do that. So, you know, it's going to look good.
That's brilliant, and it reminds me of the John Kirkman dialogue book, which has existed in two different versions, and it's going to be in a third version. So it is lovely to have those different ones to collect and enjoy. And it's also nice, isn't it, that this is Stephen Lamb we're talking about, and he's already written, and we've read in the club on track. Yes, you know, every song, every album. Yeah. So fantastic to be working with someone who is so much of a Yes fan himself.
Yeah, he's very excited about it, actually, and everything that he saw. And yeah, he's loving it, the fact that we're doing this together. So he absolutely wants this to be a really nice book. It's a bigger format than the every album, every song.
Yes.
But together, between us, we'll produce something really interesting.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to it because, like, as you said, there's been so much written about Yes itself, that to find something that's so before this to learn about, I mean, I'm very much looking forward to it. I've always wanted to know more about John's background before Yes.
Yeah, and you know, if we wait for official biographies from the guys, you know, we could wait another decade or whatever. So, you know, this is not meant to be that, but it is the best that he will see or anyone will see between, you know, the beginnings in Lancashire up to, you know, the first Yes album coming out. I'll also release a webpage that I have so much information on the tour dates. That's probably a little bit geeky and a bit nerdy, but there are various websites out there that cover the Sin, Mabel Greer's Toy Shop, and Yes for 50 years. And so this will, all my work on, because I have the diaries, you see, I have the band's diaries. So, you know, I've met
amazing.
Them, I've got the diaries. And so I've put together page upon page of, so someone can look back now and go, oh, that's what they were doing in 64, 5, 6. You know, whether it's of interest or not, I'm geeky enough to find it all very interesting and put it down for somebody else to find, maybe the one date that they're looking for, you know. There's a lot of pages. Yeah. Someone's got to do this stuff, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Someone has. And you've done it, Dave, which is brilliant. So do keep us in touch with the exact dates, and do come back on when the thing is available. We'd love to talk to you again.
I know it's early days. I know it's early days on this for October, but because we just agreed all this, and pretty much it's quite exciting time. And obviously I had a big birthday yesterday, so I launched it with that. The other thing is that I have this music that no one's heard, which I've been spending time either at Abbey Road Studios or other Northern studios in London. And I've got these acetates and tapes, physical tapes that I've had. Well, it's exciting because I went in the studios and thought, is there anything on it? It's been in a cupboard for 50 years. Yeah. What will I hear? So I've had exciting times in studios thinking it's either a needle drop onto digital, think, is anything coming from this? Or putting the reel-to-reel on and just pressing play and go, is there anything left? And there is something left on all of it.
Wow.
And so now we've got 13 minutes of music, all sort of 64, 67 demos, and John's on these vocals. So I just got to figure out a way, which I've always thought putting it on a vinyl next year.
Yeah, I have to ask, in amongst the recordings that you have there, is there anything live at all?
Well, these are just the guys playing live in the studio.
Oh, okay.
But watch this space, because other things are coming my way, just to say. That I don't know what's on the stuff yet.
Yeah.
It carries on. It carries on because I have more things.
Right. It's wonderful. Well, you say someone's got to do it, but you've done it, Dave, and this is another of your projects, which is about to come to fruition quite soon, which, you know, along with the Yes 50 stuff last year and the exhibitions and so on, you are an inspiration to all us Yes fans. And, you know, we are the geeks. We are the nerds. We are the 5%. So that's why we enjoy what you do so much. So thank you very much indeed, Dave, for coming on and talking to us today.
Well, keep yesing, all of you, and I hope you like the book when it comes out. And thanks for the time.